Okay. So, Noble Eightfold Path. Can be a tricky one here, actually. We just had a discussion, haven't we, about this word right. It's in front of every single aspect of the path. So we're going to have a little explore of that. But I think, first of all, before we get on to the guts of it, we should think about some of the context here, a little bit of the history of where the Eightfold Path came from and kind of why, actually. It's presented to us in the Pali Canon, in one of the suttas. And essentially, the order of events, the Buddha spent 7 years in the forest with the ascetics, went through a great deal of suffering, actually nearly killed him. And he realized that if he carried on in this way, he was going to die before he'd found the answer. So he gave up the ascetic path and developed what he called the middle way. After his enlightenment, his enlightenment kind of revealed to him an understanding about that nature of suffering, and he had the realization of the Four Noble Truths, that actually life itself contains suffering for us all. We don't need to kind of live on tree roots. We can actually sit at home and watch the TV and have suffering. He realized that there is actually a way out of this suffering, and it's the understanding that of why we suffer that leads us out. And through acceptance and adjusting our responses to life, we can actually let go. Well, that sounds easy then, doesn't it? And actually, the ascetics, they straight away got it, because they'd spent 7 years suffering. They knew all about it. They knew about their response to it. And it probably smacked them in the face when they saw it and thought, why didn't I think of that? However, for the rest of us, the path to it, that understanding, is very, very difficult. We can understand it at an academic level, but we have to actually feel it. And so that first sermon that he presented was to those ascetics, and therefore, you know what they say about giving a presentation? Know your audience. And he did. So I'm sure he adjusted his pitch accordingly. But of course, then he had a much bigger challenge, because for the Buddha, it was a desire of his to spread this message out to the general population, to the people he saw around him that were suffering. And he realized he needed to give them an actual path to follow. Hence the birth of the Eightfold Path. The components of the path, they're not seen as individual steps. They intertwine and support each other, which is why I generated this little diagram here, which I was very proud of, my PowerPoint skills. And for me, it feels like this. It feels like you're spiraling upwards, and each time, you don't just go through one of the paths once, you know. You come around it again and again. And they all elements, components of the path support each other. We can see that actually the ultimate target, if you like, of this journey is wisdom, is understanding. That really is what enlightenment is. It's wisdom. So during the next 8 weeks, we're going to look at each of these components and actually how they relate to us in the modern world, because let's face it, it's pretty different to the way it was in the Buddha's day. So we've got to think about that, and we have to think about how it relates to us personally. So, you know, this path, it is a very individual process. But let's go into it and have a look at it. So you can see it as split into three main parts. So eight components in three main parts. And the first one is what we call the moral discipline group, if you like. right speech, right action, right livelihood. So it's interesting, isn't it? We've delved into a place immediately which differs to our modern society. So when we think about ethics and morality in our modern society, we have a very detailed structure around us in the form of our laws and you know, our rights and all this stuff that has been written down and presented to us, and it's very, very complex. And actually, none of us can know it in detail. But I think there is a premise here with the Eightfold Path, which is actually, when we talk about right speech, right action, right livelihood, as an individual, we don't need it written down. We have a intuitive knowledge of what is right and what is wrong. That's a controversial statement. Nature or nurture. The second group, the concentration group, which is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And in many ways, this group we've been exploring a lot in our meditations today. We've really been learning about this area. So probably when we come to these bits, more of it will be easier to latch on to and understand. And then the last group, the wisdom group, right view and right intention. So it's interesting, we're going to start with right view, one of the last ones of the lot. And it might feel like we've got to dive into things like right livelihood, right action, but actually we need right view. Why is that? Well, put it simply, when you set out on a journey, you need to know where you're going, otherwise you're not going to get there. And the Eightfold Path, actually, it starts and ends with right view, which is why it's there on the diagram. Now, how can that be? So it starts and ends with right view. How can we have the right view at the start and also at the end? Surely if we know it at the start, why have we got to head off the path anyway? Because we're there, surely, already enlightened. Well, that's interesting. And I think immediately that reveals something about each of these components. They're not fixed. They're not static. I mean, let's face it, what would be the point of the practice if they were? We weren't going to learn anything because we knew it all anyway. So clearly, the Eightfold Path presents us something that it is going to change during our practice and our lifetime. So the view we hold at the start will definitely change and be redefined as we practice and we go through. But if there is a right view, why didn't the Buddha just tell us what it was? That would have been a lot easier, wouldn't it? And of course, the truth to that is the view, it has to be felt. It's not something that can be just explained. We've got to feel it. It's not an academic thing. And what that also means is that it may be different to each of us. It's not going to be a cast in stone thing. It's going to be very, very individual. At the beginning, it may well be quite mundane, actually. It'd be fairly superficial things that we consider as right view. But as our practice deepens, so the right view deepens, and our understanding of the Dharma and the direction it presents also deepen. Certainly the Four Noble Truths give us some place to start, but there's going to be a great deal more in our initial view than this. I mean, going back to that first sermon, the Four Noble Truths are often put up there as the heart of Buddhism. another controversial statement coming here. I wonder if the only reason that that is there is because of the audience the Buddha was presenting to. Because he was presenting to those ascetics that had travelled through the forest with him. He knew how they'd suffered, and therefore his first sermon was about suffering. Maybe if he'd had a different audience, the focus would have been more on compassion. Who knows? Controversial statement there. So, right view, as we go through our progress, we have to start to let go of some of the things that have built our spiritual practice to date. We may well go into Buddhist practice with an understanding of certain aspects of what it is to be spiritual. But even these we'll have to start to let go. They'll help us at the start of the journey, there's no doubt. But slowly the importance around these things that we've held dear, we might have to lessen. Our dependence, for example, on, say, ritual and beliefs in supernatural things or superstitions even, that brought us into Buddhist practice in the first place, we may find they start to evaporate. Some years ago, the Buddhist group up in Hertfordshire that I used to practice with, a young lady came along, and she was actually very honest about what brought her into the practice. And she said that she came in because of her love for the potential psychic abilities that Buddhist practice may give her. Very unusual perspective, but that was it. She was looking for magic, actually. That's why she came in. But as her practice deepened, she let go of this, and gradually she moved away from it, and she ended up just loving the pure mindfulness meditation. She discovered the magic simply in the breath. She went on to become an ordained nun. So her right view definitely changed. So how do we get hold of this word right that we came to in the first place? Well, actually, from my reading, my understanding and the teaching that I've had, a real word that's helped me in establishing an understanding around this is the word wholesome. The Buddha, obviously, he didn't call it wholesome, it was some unpronounceable Pali word, but it appears again and again in the texts, wholesome. So he encouraged us to look at our thoughts and our actions and ask ourselves if they were wholesome practice. And actually, if they were wholesome to us, you know, are they actually helping us forward in some way, shape or form, or are they damaging us? Each individual thought and action. And it's here that the understanding of right, for me, comes from. Buddhists, we love lists. we really do. And you could make a big list of what's wholesome and what's unwholesome. But there's thousands of examples here. The Buddha tried to help us by giving us a list of unwholesome things as a starting point. Okay. And, you know, they jump out the page as being blindingly obvious. Number one is destroying life. That is definitely an unwholesome practice. Number two, taking what isn't given. Stealing, theft. That's not very nice. Three, wrong conduct in regard to the sense pleasures. Number four, false speech, telling lies. number five, pretty close to it, is slanderous speech. And number six, harsh speech. So there's a whole section there in what we do with our words. Idle chatter, number 7. Number 8, covetousness, leading to jealousy. Number 9, ill will. And number 10, this is tricky, wrong view. That's an interesting one, isn't it? And actually, as we step through these 10 aspects of unwholesome behaviour, we can say that they become more and more related to mind and more subtle, possibly more easy to fall into, if you like. You know, the obvious ones at the start, because they're so obvious, we can avoid them fairly easily. The more subtle ones, we might not even spot when we're doing it. One of the key practices in Buddhism is holding silence, the noble silence. We're going to try it out actually in the house. There'll be information coming out on this. We're going to have a 24-hour silence. Ooh. Okay. And one of the reasons for holding it is to help us with this central four: false speech, slanderous speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. And the reason we do it, we hold silence, is because normally thoughts arise in the mind and bleh, out they come. Now the thing is, when we're holding silence, those thoughts still arise in the mind, but the very act of holding back means we spot them and we see them being formed and being born in the mind. So we really start to notice our mental behaviours before the bleh. And therefore it's good practice, you know, we start to see how our mind works and tune into it. So certainly the practice of silence helps us deal with some of the more subtle aspects of unwholesome behaviour as we work through this list. But as we get down to the bottom, covetousness, ill will and wrong view becomes much more subtle, and we've got to work a lot harder with our mindfulness practice. To help us with this, the Buddha painted a view of the roots of these various unwholesome practices. There's something sitting underneath that leads to all of these. And he realised that these were greed, desire, aversion and delusion. And actually, these we all suffer with. Even the Buddha talked about them. Right through the Buddha's life, there was a demon that stalked him, called Mara. And Mara reappears in the Pali Canon again and again right the way through his life. And we can form a view that it's a real demon with fiery fangs and wonderful things like that. Actually, I think that, and lots of people think, that Mara was, you know, the roots of these unwholesome behaviours constantly stalking him, greed, aversion and delusion. And right up to the point of his enlightenment, Mara was there chucking arrows at him. It's quite interesting. As we progress through our understanding of right view and wrong view, they become more subtle. Life is really complex. One of the mantras that I personally find useful but also a bit of a pain in the neck because it's constantly stalking me out there is the mantra to avoid harm. Now, when I wake in the morning today, I'm going to avoid harm. The trouble is, in order to avoid hurting one person, often we end up hurting others. And sometimes we can't even see we've done it. So actually, this practice of right view and wrong view is very, very tough. Learning to pick our way through this gets very difficult. But I think as long as we start with that premise and we start heading out on the path, that's got to be a good thing. So as I said at the start, when we start to follow this path, we start to really feel something. We start to feel a difference in our life, actually. And this is often called the ripenings. All of these unwholesome actions and their opposites, the wholesome ones, they're all, without exception, driven by the mind. And they all leave an imprint on the mind. So in a way, this process is very simple. When we choose to follow a right view, we're stepping away from unwholesome actions which damage the mind, cause us suffering, towards wholesome things which ripen in the mind and actually give us happiness. So we start to feel it. In this modern world, we see many examples of subtle and less than subtle moral and ethical behaviour. It's very easy to step up on our soapbox and look at things with criticism. And the place in this modern world you see this is in social media. But even in Buddhist forums, I see examples of people trying to be the best Buddhist and grandstanding their positions over others. And in many ways, this is touching so many elements of that list we just looked at, the unwholesome practices. Certainly, it's touching harsh speech. By making themselves look good, they stamp on somebody else. But this type of behaviour, it just does not take us forward along the Eightfold Path. It's causing damage. So our journey along the Eightfold Path can only be made by us. Stepping on others won't help at all. It's a very, very personal thing. So to get to grips of that right view, the starting point, I thought we'd do a little bit of a self-experiment today. And it's quite an interesting one. Warwick's looking worried already. Okay. Because we need to understand what we personally feel about that right view. Nobody else, just us. And there's a bit of a way to get to the heart of this. So, be brave. I want you to close your eyes. Just close your eyes gently. Get yourself comfy. Close your eyes. And just tune into the space a little and just relax into the seat. Take a couple of nice deep breaths. Okay. You've just died. It didn't hurt. You didn't see it coming. But your life has just ended. Just take some breaths and let that sink in. Examine how you feel. It's a few days later, and your friends and family are missing you. Work is wondering how to cope. Just take some breaths. See how you feel. It's a year later. Friends and family, they miss you, but they're getting on with their lives. Work, they've sorted things out. Some people can't remember your name. You made an impact on the world. That impact is now softening. Take some breaths. How do you feel? Think about your life. What regrets do you have? Things that you should have done. Things that you did. Get a general impression of your life. A general feeling associated with those regrets. Think about how you would have done things differently. What you would have done. Take some breaths and let that sink in. Let me give you some news. You have your life back. Today, we start again. And relax and open your eyes. Well, that might give you a view. So what we're going to do this morning is a nice meditation on the breath, just gently settling into our breath, and whatever conclusions, whatever feelings you had during that little exercise, just let that bubble up and sink in the background, and just go with that. So settling down. Relaxing into our postures and just tune into the room around us. Feeling the space. Ground gently supporting us underneath. And awareness of our friends sitting with us, all supporting each other in this meditation. We'll start with our little Buddhist mantra. Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Nama, Am. Hung. In a body scan. Let's take our minds down into our feet. And gently get in touch with all of the sensations there. Exploring. Deep inside the feet and out on the surface. And we work across the soles of the feet, up over the heels. Working up through the ankle bones. And up into the shins and the calf muscles. Keeping the mind gently focused on where we've got to in the body. We come to the knees. Any aches and pains, just relax them, soften out, noticing the tension that builds around them. Breathe into it. Work along thighs and hamstrings. Starting to feel a sense of letting go. Relaxing into the sensations. Gentle, compassionate approach. And into the sitting bones, sinking into the seat. As you breathe, feel yourself letting go into the seat. On each out breath. Relaxing down, we allow the head to float up a little. Feel the spine easing out, unkinking. Sense of fresh intent to stay with the practice present in the mind. And bringing our awareness into the stomach and the heart area. Feeling the emotions there. not the stories of them, just the pure emotion itself. Feel compassion in the heart, metta. Metta has the power to melt ill will. It can burn through greed, aversion, and delusion, softness of heart. And our awareness comes into the shoulders. Any tension there, let it go, melt it out. We travel down the upper arms, forearms, into our hands and our fingers. Feeling a gentle resolution that these hands will only offer kindness, wholesome action, generosity. And we come back up to the head. Exploring the scalp with the tiniest of sensations. Soften the gaze. Compassionate feeling behind the eyes, easing out the muscles. Gentle smile on the lips. Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. We go into our breath. As we gently breathe on each out breath, hear the word calm echo in the mind and settle itself in our hearts. Just the breath. No choices in the breath, right or wrong. It's just the breath. Letting thoughts go, breathing gently, calm. letting go of thoughts, creating space in the mind for understanding and wisdom to come through. Just the breath. Calm. Let's let go of the word and bring all of our awareness, our concentration, just to the breath, creating a nice big space for understanding to come up. Just the breath. Notice the playful pull of the mind as it tries to take you away from the breath. Gently bring yourself back. Just the breath. Cultivating a silky spaciousness of the concentrated mind, we focus on the breath. right view. It doesn't come from a place of critique for others. It gives us an opportunity to look at ourselves and our lives with total self-honesty. We look at what's wholesome, what's going to take us forward on our spiritual journey. And when you're ready, open your eyes and bring your meditation to an end. Om Mani Padme Hum.